One of our editors is a Gaelic specialist, and we were really keen that at least a fifth of the volume should be made up of poems written in Gaelic, and that there should be a good quality translation of the poetry written in Gaelic. We also have poems here written in Scots of different sorts. And one of the reasons I think we wanted to have an anthology of poetry written in by Scots was that we wanted to show the diversity of the linguistic diversity as much as anything else.
Faith at the Fringe, a Sanctuary First podcast series. Uncovering God in the creative arts. At the biggest international arts festival in the world, Sanctuary First stops to ask, where does faith and art meet?
Welcome to episode 2 for Faith at the Fringe 2024. We are back here again in St Cuthbert's with the minister here, Reverend Peter Sutton. Peter, great and lovely to be back again. It's really super to be in this really special room, actually. We were just chatting a little bit about the windows that are set behind us and how they depict the story of St Cuthbert.
They are, and very sadly, not many people see them. But hopefully on these podcasts, everyone will be soon queuing up.
Indeed. Yeah. So you watch the podcast if you want to see St Cuthbert's story in stained glass window. But also join us on the podcast today because we have some real champions of poetry and faith. And we are really delighted to have the Reverend Professor Alison Jack. Alison, lovely to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you. Alison is the principal of New College at Edinburgh University and also the professor of biblical literature, professor of Bible and literature, that right? at Edinburgh University, and also a co-editor of a brand new book, Scottish Religious Poetry, which we're going to be talking a lot about today. So thank you again. And we also have the Reverend Professor Gordon Graham with us.
Hello.
Hi, Gordon. Great that you are with us. Gordon is the director of the Edinburgh Festival of Sacred Arts and was formerly the Professor of Philosophy and Art at Princeton Theological Seminary. So great that you're with us, both of you. Thank you for coming along today. So when I said that we have the champion of arts and faith, I was not underestimating the two contributors that we have. So Alison and Gordon, delighted that you're here with us. So thank you. Peter, I'm really looking forward to this conversation we're about to have. It's all about poetry and faith and how they cross over and how they weave in together. And really, how does poetry impact the fringe? How does faith impact poetry impacting society?
Yeah, likewise, Ruth. And we had a wee bit of a taster of that, I think, in the last podcast with Callum, because he said that the winning prize for the musical part of the Sacred Art Festival was based on a piece of poetry set to music. So I think this is a really good follow-up from our last talk.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just dive straight in, shall we? Alison, I would love to hear a little bit more about this book that you have been working on and that is having a fantastic show, if it can be called a show, a launch event as part of the Fringe Festival. Can you please tell us a little bit about the book and the history in terms of how it's all come together?
Of course. I always love to have a chance to talk about this anthology, and maybe I can show the camera. Here it is. And with my co-editors, Lyndon Bickett and Emma Dimmock, we realised there had been a previous anthology of Scottish religious poetry, which came out in the year 2000. And three great poets, Meg Bateman, Robert Crawford, and James McGonagall, were the editors of that volume. And it was now out of print. And indeed, the editors of that volume, in their introduction, said, there's going to have to be another one, because Scotland's changing. And within the 21st century, we're going to have to reflect new religious beliefs, new ways of expressing faith in poetry. So we spoke to the editors and they were very happy for us to take on the task. And Hymns Ancient and Modern, who oversee St Andrew's Press, were also very keen for us to take the task on. And so we set to it. But it did take us a good while. It's taken us a good couple of years to make our selections, fight over which poems were going to go in, which ones were going to we were going to have to leave out, write the introduction, and also get all the permissions that we knew we would need for the new volume. But we're delighted it's now in print and that there's going to be an event at the Festival of the Sacred Arts to celebrate its launch.
And why not? Let's have the plug then for your launch event right at the beginning. Gordon, this is part of your festival as well. When's your launch event?
Well, the festival begins with a service in Canongate Kirk, actually, on Sunday the 11th in the morning. And then this poetry event is the first event in the afternoon, and that will be in Sacred Heart Church, the Jesuit church in Lauriston Place.
That was in the afternoon of
the same day, Sunday the 11th.
Sunday the 11th. So Sunday the 11th in the afternoon, we can all come along. Is it ticketed?
It's ticketed, and you can get tickets at the door. You can buy them online in advance. But Sacred Heart, if you've ever been there, it's not a magnificent place, actually, but it's huge. So no one should think the seats will run out. They won't.
Great. So we can all come along and we can hear more about the book. But let's hear a little bit more about that. You mentioned about wrangling over what was going to be included and not. That's interesting, Peter.
Yeah, well, I remember, Alison, coming to your inaugural professorial lecture when I think some of the editorial team were there, and that very much came up as a question. I remember how difficult it was going to be to make the final cut, and I'm guessing that proved to be the case, but here it is, so you must have got there, obviously.
Well, we say in the introduction it was a little akin to choosing between our children sometimes, but we got there. We were obviously building on very strong foundations. We had the work that the other editors had done, and we didn't touch too much. We didn't force many changes in the early part of the book. We knew they were experts in St. Columba and in The Dream of the Rood and of Robert Burns. I mean, Robert Crawford's an expert on Robert Burns. So we weren't going to fiddle around too much with their early choices. But in 20, 24 years, things had changed. And there are some poets who were only really coming to prominence in the year 2000. Kathleen Jamie, Liz Lockhead. Well, Liz Lockhead had been around quite a long time, but she's gone on to produce new and different poetry. Someone such as Jackie Kay. We had to look again at all the work that had been produced since the year 2000, and really we wanted to showcase some of these more modern poets. We also wanted to look back at some of the canonical poets, such as Edwin Morgan and Sorley MacLean and Ian Crichton-Smith, people who have for a long time been considered extremely important religious poets in many ways, and look again at using some of the more recent scholarship around their work. So we made slightly different choices, but of course we were always constrained, not just by the number of pages we were allowed in the book, but also by the cost of permissions. And so some of those great poets who are with prestigious titles, prestigious publishers, I'm afraid we would have loved to have some more, but it was just beyond our budget. And then, of course, there was the fact that Scotland is a much more multicultural place than it was even 20 years ago. And we knew there were many new exciting poets from a range of different religious backgrounds. And so Alicia Pir Mohammed, an award-winning poet from the Muslim tradition, is in our book. Jeanette Ayachi, Kevin McNeil, who's a Buddhist poet. We wanted to include that diversity of voices, as well as the up-and-coming and the established voices from the Christian tradition, and other poets who perhaps wouldn't think of themselves as religious, but we felt that their poets, their poems, deserved a place in this anthology.
And so with that in mind, with the interfaith sort of angle in mind, did you sort of theme poems around, you know, say, for instance, peace, and then that allowed you to put various religions together, or were these all standalone poets in their own right and you presented them as such?
I wish we had been as clever as that taken a thematic approach, but actually we followed the way that the previous editors had done it and simply arrange the poems according to the birth date of the poets. So you get a sweep, you get a historical sweep rather than a sense of religious themes or motifs. But we did find themes and motifs weaving their way through the volume, there's no doubt about that. And as we were choosing poems, if they did make reference to something that was concretely Scottish, then it was more likely that we would include them. We've got Bishabhi Fraser's poem, A Gurdwara in Leith. Now, that just seemed to us to be perfect for what we were trying to do. So that was one of the ways that we selected. We often just chose, I shouldn't really say this in public, but sometimes it was really just on what poems spoke to us. More about their power than their piety. And that's actually a phrase from the previous introduction. And that helped us to shape and to decide often what was going to go in.
Because often the easy question to ask you might be, what's your favourite poem? But make it slightly more challenging than that. Which one are you slightly sad didn't make the cut? Which we got left behind?
Well, that's interesting because I did prepare that answer. Wondering if you might ask me it. When we were at the beginning of working on the book, I was doing quite a bit of work on Norman McCaig. And he was already in the anthology. And we have changed one or two of the poems. But one I really enjoy is a poem called Illumination. It's based on a moment around Loch Fuin, where he describes walking through dull cloud darkness for 4 days. They're on one of their expeditions that he was famous for. And then all of a sudden, a shaft of light comes through the cloud. And he talks about being as if he's in a medieval manuscript. And his hands are translucent with love.
And that didn't make it in.
Oh. I know. But when you publish with Faber, I'm afraid there's the problem.
So you mentioned about themes. You didn't arrange them thematically, but that themes and motifs emerge throughout the course of the book. So what would one of them, for example, what would one of those themes that you've noticed from the writings, what would one be?
One would certainly be a connection to the land and to the power of the natural world or the industrial world, the urban world, to cause a reaction, to inspire something deep within one. So, yes, we can all understand that the cover of the book, you know, suggests that when one's in nature, you can have a sense of the divine. But equally, some of the poems speak of being in church, of being within a holy or sacred building, and that inspiring their work. Or in other contexts, being just trying to think of one in particular. But certainly this idea of Scotland as a place being an important motif, and an interpretation or a wrangling of meaning out of a situatedness, a place-filled spirituality as being important.
Well, I think I was just going to hand over. I was just very quickly going to say that that's something that came out of our last conversation with Callum. Mm. And although we were talking music, we also ended up talking about the importance of space as well. And I think that's exactly where your festival sort of brings all these various components together.
I guess so. I mean, the abiding purpose of the festival is to enable church members, often churches and religiously inspired people, to draw on the astonishing Christian tradition in all the arts. So it's important that it's all the arts, and it's important that the Christian tradition, which tends to be neglected, relegated, discounted in the world of the arts in general, that rich inheritance is brought back into the full attention. So I think what we're trying to do, and one other thing, let me just say about the Festival of the Sacred Arts, it is striking, if you live in Edinburgh, that the vast majority of performers in the fringe are, so to speak, parachuted in. This includes the festival itself, of course, the International Festival. So one thing we're trying to do is enable more local people, locally engaged people, to, as it were, participate in the Fringe as festival and as church people. So holding these things together is what we're really about. But could I just return to poetry in this volume for a moment? I have a different question, which is sort of thematic. Why have a volume of Scottish religious poetry? And what makes it Scottish? Is it just that people were born in Scotland? And when you come across very diverse kinds of poetry, why put them in one collection? I mean, an obvious contrast between Gaelic poetry and English language poetry. And I think I say this as someone who is Irish. I think in Ireland, there is, if I put it this way, a kind of literary Irish English that came into existence and provided the linguistic materials for a whole range of people, some of them extremely talented, like Yeats and so on, but poets and dramatists. But you could identify that as an English that, to put it this way, English people wouldn't be writing. And it has some structural connections, but it wasn't anything to do with, or not much to do with, the attempt to restore and reawaken the Irish language. Mm. So there, I think there is something I can point to and say, that's Irish literature. But what about holding together all these different bits under the label Scottish?
Yes, it is a complex situation. And we haven't discussed, although I should have mentioned, that our Emma Dimmock, one of our editors, is a Gaelic specialist. And we were really keen that at least a fifth of the volume should be made up of poems written in Gaelic, and that there should be a good quality translation of the poetry written in Gaelic. We also have poems here written in Scots of different sorts. And one of the reasons I think we wanted to have an anthology of poetry written in by Scots was that we wanted to show the diversity of the linguistic diversity as much as anything else. And often we have a poem in Scots by one author and equally a poem in English by the same author, demonstrating that linguistic elasticity, that linguistic power. And some of these poets would say that Scots is the language that allows them to express their spirituality in the most real way to them. So we wanted to present to the public that linguistic diversity, and for them to be able to see, well, does what speaks to me? What of these poems that we've included in Doric, in Gaelic, in Old Scots, what really talks to me about issues of spirituality in a way that is important to me as a Scot or as someone living in Scotland? So the linguistic variety was something we wanted to hold on to very strongly. So it's a different sort of diversity. And I think actually that's one of the differences between the original volume and our volume, in that the modern writers, some of them anyway, are very self-consciously and confidently writing in Scots as well as in English. And it's good, I think, for us to demonstrate that.
I was going to say, Ruth, gosh, I think true academics are much tougher with each other on their questions. I think ours have been pretty light in comparison, but that's a fascinating answer. And you brought out the word diversity there, Alison. I think maybe time now to hit. It would be lovely if you could read a poem which picks up on anything that you've been talking about.
Yes, now. I really wanted to ask you if you were talking about how it speaks to people, with whether it's Doric or Gaelic or Old Scots. And I just wondered, you know, if you were one of those people reading the book and hadn't been contributing as a co-editor with it, what would grasp your attention? What did you find really speaking to you in all of this?
Well, one thing we discovered, one of the poems in the book was written by a great, 19th century intellectual, Thomas Carlyle, born in Scotland, lived most of his life in London, a famous agnostic, shall we say? Do you think, Gordon? Do you think, Gordon, would that be?
I guess so, yes.
Yeah. And he has a quite a famous poem called Qui Bono. So if I read that, and then I'm going to read a poem that his wife, Jane Welsh Carlyle, wrote that wasn't published, but we discovered it. It wasn't published in her lifetime. And I think it answers many of these questions that he's raising. And I love the fact that we've got that dialogue in the book. So, Qui Bono by Thomas Carlyle. What is hope? A smiling rainbow children follow through the wet. 'Tis not here, still yonder, yonder. Never urchin found it yet. What is life? A thawing ice board on a sea with sunny shore. Gay we sail, it melts beneath us. We are sunk and seen no more. What is man? A foolish baby vainly strives and fights and frets, demanding all, deserving nothing. One small grave is all he gets. So,
provocative.
Provocative. Plenty of that skeptical, questioning, doubting, anger almost at God in this volume. But then let's hear Jane Welsh Carlyle, and we can hear something of that dialogue within the relationship, perhaps. It's called Nay, This Is Hope. Nay, this is hope, a gentle dove that nestles in the gentle breast, bringing glad tidings from above of joys to come and heavenly rest. And this is life, ethereal fire striving aloft through smothering clay, mounting, flaming, higher, higher, till lost in immortality. And man, oh, hate not nor despair that fairest, lordliest work of God. Think not he made the wise and good only to sleep beneath the sod. So, not great, great poetry, but still, you've sensed something of the heartfelt nature of that response, of something that she finds deeply personal and deeply meaningful for her. And something resonates within me in that dialogue and that debate.
It's a lovely conversation just between the two poems there. You know, it really is, and how they almost answer one another, as you were saying. And it just makes me think of poetry in a little bit of a wider sense as well, in terms of, did you find some of the works that you've considered answering questions or answering issues that we might face in society in a more wider sense? I mean, you mentioned about how the world has changed in 20, 24 years, so you wanted to reflect that. And so I'm just wondering around that reflection of the changes, were there some poems in particular that answered some key issues that we are facing in these days? And how did, if it did, how did religion weave its way through in that?
I feel very strongly that poetry isn't there to answer questions, but rather to suggest answers or to raise new questions. And I think there is something in the poetic form which encourages the reader to engage and to think about the issues raised in a way that is personal to them without shutting down a conversation. It's something about the careful, considered, unusual combination of words on a line, in a line, in a verse format, that just makes the reader pause, think, and reflect. And so what I find in the poems is more often that, not an answer, but something that makes me think further. And maybe I could read just a tiny bit of a poem by Jen Hadfield. Let me just find it, who is a poet who is based now in Shetland. Let me see.
Actually, I'll tell you what, Alison, while you find that one, can I just pick up three words for Gordon that came from what Alison mentioned, pause, think, and reflect, and how poetry ultimately perhaps is, you know, encouraging us to do that. Would you say we can explore that in all the different facets within the Sacred Arts Festival? Would those be three words that you would sign up to?
Well, let me just go back to the poetry for a minute. Yeah. See, I think that this idea that poems are essentially personal and speak to us personally, and that they maybe prompt us to reflect, that's a very, very modern, I shall say 20th century, intensified in the 21st century. If you think of the greatest Christian poets, and I'll just cite as one Charles Wesley, who Helen Gardner, the great, great literary critic, reckoned that Charles Wesley was the greatest Christian poet. His poems, and some of them are just astonishingly craftful. They were there to be sung. They were for people to use together, and to both affirm their faith and to express their anxieties and their hopes. And, you know, there's a nice story, which I owe to Helen Gardner, long since dead, of course, and she remarks that it used to be a bit of a joke that a duchess was seen in church singing, "Were the whole realms of nature mine, it were an offering far too small," while she, as the story goes, reached in her purse for a sixpence to put on the plate. And Gardner says this is a sort of unfair mockery. The words, in that case, of Isaac Watts' poem, another brilliant, brilliant poem, are to give people an aspiration, not to reflect how they feel, but rather to enable them to aspire to feel in certain ways. And this is what I feel about when I hear about people comment on poets, and including, I will say, most modern poets. They are radically individualistic. And it's all about personal feeling and personal sentiment and personal reflection. And I think that's actually very different from the long-standing tradition.
Specifically, I think of that long-standing tradition, particularly as it's sung now within, certainly in the Church of Scotland, in the Psalms, because they obviously were written reflecting on all of life. And today we certainly hear at St. Cuthbert's, we always sing a psalm after the epistle, before the gospel, and it's held as a treasured, I think, because we feel we're touching words, you know, that were written as poetry, but we have the privilege of singing them. And just letting that float for a minute, I think Alison's found...
I have found maybe something slightly different, but just to pick up the Psalms point, what we have included here are some of the traditional translations of the Psalms from the General Assembly committees of the 17th and 18th centuries, and also William Keith's translation of the 100th Psalm as being absolutely part of the poetic tradition of Scotland.
And there would be no real General Assembly unless each morning... Yeah. We started, you know, singing a psalm together. Yeah.
Well, it's not always a psalm anymore, makes me a little sad. Yeah. But you're right; it's deep wired within us. And several of our more modern poets have also engaged with the Psalms. Diana Hendry is one. Psalm 88, Blues. "Lord, when I'm speechless, when something, not just sorrow, but under that a dull, numb, nameless dreich about the heart I hardly seem to have, when this afflicts me, when hope's been cancelled, when the pilot light of me's put out, when every reflex and response has been extinguished, send word, snowdrop, child, light." Now that's very much setting Psalm 88 in a Christian context, but you can see the engagement with it. And then a very popular poet within the Church of Scotland, Jock Stein, has recently translated or has represented many of the Psalms. We have one of his 119 Fair and Square. "No life complete without God's art and music, hidden in our sober prose, artless, silent, waiting for the word to waken, say hello and introduce a new dimension, dancing intimacy to the edge of long horizons, splashing color on a great allegro." Just a certain brio to that.
Well, Jock Stein is, of course, a really good friend within the Sanctuary First community, and it's wonderful that here in the book and at the General Assembly that they have a platform in order to share their art and their craft and to give of their skill and talents to reflect and to help us and provoke and give questions. And I'm just wondering, Gordon, from your perspective, looking at a Festival of Arts as well, that you have made a key choice to include poetry as part of that festival, is it challenging? Is it difficult? Is it easy for people of faith or religion who write poetry to share, to have that platform? Or how are their writings typically received?
Well, I only have this by report, but... And certainly if you read modern anthologies, you will find that explicitly, expressly, religious poetry doesn't appear very often, and avowedly Christian poetry, perhaps even less so. Now, of course, we live in a secularized society, and this is probably different in countries where there is still a very strong Christian tradition. But I think it's one of the striking things in my experience in organizing this festival that sacred music still has a pretty deep and strong resonance, and right down into the youngest generations. So the Young Composers competition that we organized and which will conclude had no difficulty. I should say Young was 21 years and under. So it had no difficulty in getting entries, and some of them of the highest quality. I was suggesting to different people, could we do something like that for painting, maybe? Could we do something like that for poetry? And I asked this to a painter and to a poet, and I was told, no, it wouldn't fly. It wouldn't fly. And I think that's interesting. If it would fly, I would do it, of course.
Hope, as we read your new book, that's actually one of the things that we gather and experience in the poetry as well, that it speaks coming out from a life that we might know and recognize as well. And I think, just summing up as we're coming to close as well, that it's just really striking how rich poetry is in terms of what depths of life it churns and all highlights and just brings into the whole mixture of life, and just the wonder that it can bring to a person as well, just to wonder at God, to wonder at life, and to have that childlike wonder. I think it's even the excerpts that you've read for us today have just really brought that wonder. It's been beautiful. So thank you. Peter, what's your one-minute takeaway?
My one-minute take is we had the privilege here at St. Cuthbert's of launching CH4, the supplement, just a few weeks ago. And for me, it's so exciting. I know it's not to steal the thunder of your official launch, but for me, it's so beautiful that these poems should have been shared in this sacred space, just as those new hymns were sung. And for me, that just gives me something very special, not just to share from this moment, but also to share with this space that so many people have gone through. And I'm really excited about the launch too. I think it's going to be wonderful. So thank you very much.
Yeah. So thank you, Alison, and thank you, Gordon.
Pleasure.
Yeah. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Peter, thank you much for all your insight and passion.
Well, and good luck with the rest of the podcast and your new number two when they arrive.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for this Faith at the Fringe podcast all about poetry. I pray and hope that you have been blessed, and that you reach for those poetry books. Scottish Religious Poetry is the name of the book that Alison co-edited. And we will have the links for you for the event that's coming up for the launch of it as well. So thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.